right. Well, folks, you know you're in for a treat when you hear that tune, because it means it's time for another week of the Rec Poker Podcast. I'm so excited to be here because I've got the best freaking job in the world. I get to hang out here on Monday night and talk to my friends about this fantastic game of poker that we all love so much. This is a forums edition of the podcast, which means that we're going to be taking a hand from our absolutely free forums over at rec.poker and talking about it here on the air. Most of what we do is free. We're a largely volunteer-based organization, so I have to thank our sponsors, the Running Aces Hotel, Racetrack, and Casino. And I also have to thank our Wrecking Crew members, because like I said, I'm Jim Reed, Bluffsterini in the home game, and at Rec Poker Jim on Twitter and Threads. But I'm just one piece of the team, the magic crew over here that makes all that all the magic happen. And you can find out more about me and the rest of the Wrecking Crew by going to rec.poker/crew. But you can also just listen up, because you're going to meet a few of them tonight, alphabetically by first name, starting with producing co-host Chris Jones.
I always get the easy job, unless
Ben's here.
Yeah. I'm Chris Jones. You can find me 5B5 on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky. I'm trying them all out right now, trying to figure out which one's going to win.
And I'm Joe Coolis. You can find me at Joe Cool PhD, cool with a K on Twitter, and Elvita11 in the home game.
And I'm John Somsky. I'm Poker Geek MN everywhere.
Hey, I'm Joseph Wills. I am Hockey_Poker on Twitter X and Hockey_Poker702 in the home game.
And I'm Rob Washam, and I'm Rabman50 just about everywhere.
And I'm Sasha Sutton, Poker for Girls on Twitter, and you can find me on the Rec Poker website on my study group page.
Right on. Well, that's the Wrecking Crew. This is the group that gets together and puts their time in every day, week, and month, helping our audience and our members get better at poker, sharing their love for this great game. And that's why I'm so grateful to be a part of this fantastic team. So I mentioned we were going to be taking a look at a forum post today. This is a post by Benmar24, who I happen to know is my friend Elizabeth Bennett Martin, one of the PFFs. If you're familiar with the show, you know what that means. And I am very excited to see her back here as a premium member. Elizabeth's a very accomplished recreational player. I think won the women's event in Ireland last year and has had some other fantastic results. And, you know, I'm just saying she's been a member here for a while, too. And I'm not saying one caused the other, but like, you know, it can't just be a huge coincidence that these members are coming in here, soaking up all the knowledge and then going on to great things in the poker world. So this is a strategy hand with a little color added to it, because it's a hand review that also features an annoying player. So I'll just get into the post here from Elizabeth, and then I'll see what our group has to say about it. So this is game number one of an 8-game series for a WSOP main event buy-in. So this is a like a satellite tournament that Elizabeth's playing with a group of people. They'll play 8 games, and whoever has the most points at the end of the series will win a main event ticket for the WSOP. It's a fantastic way to go leverage your play into a high ticket item you wouldn't be able to play otherwise. So this is the first game of the 8-game series. The level is 200-400. Under the Gun, who's on a 75 big blind stack, raises to 2.5 bigs or 1,000 chips. Our hero, Elizabeth, is on the button with 57 big blinds. So they are covered. And they have kings, and they raise to 3,200. So 3.2 times the original open. The small blind and the big blind fold, and the under the gun player calls with Elizabeth covered. The flop comes 2 of hearts, 8 of diamonds, 5 of spades. Under the gun player checks. Elizabeth bets 4,000 and gets check raised all in. So this is the spot. And I think, Chris, you've already started smiling. I don't know if this is a good place to sort of pause and talk about the action, or if we should include all the other information and go from there. I don't see anyone unmuting, so I'll just continue. So, our hero does fold to the check raise, and gets shown 9-7 suited, which had a backdoor flush and a gut shot straight draw. And Elizabeth says, this was a loose aggressive player, my nemesis in this poker league. He typically busts early and more of a nuisance than a competitor, which is a great way to describe someone in the seat. So I don't know if they're listening or not, but Elizabeth says, I'd appreciate comments on the hand and tips for handling this kind of character. So we got two great responses in here already. One from Apple on My Eye, a Canadian member. I won't dox them, but a fantastic guy. And one from Rabman50. Rob, do you want to talk a little bit about your response here before we get into some of the other elements of the hand? Oh, you're there. You go.
What I responded with, and it's obviously very easy to respond this way when you saw the results. But one of the things she talked about is that this is a very loose, aggressive player. You almost call him a maniac. Anybody who calls a three bet with a suited gapper under the gun. Well, first of all, who's opening 7-9 suited under the gun to begin with?
Right.
So we all obviously know he's very loose and he's very aggressive. The thing about this flop is Elizabeth Ben Martin actually gave away the strength of her hand when she three bet. Now, obviously, I would have three bet in the same spot. I think everybody would, but it was very easy to see what the strength of her hand was. So he knows that this flop totally missed her. And he could still have pocket sevens, pocket eights, pocket fives. He could even have pocket deuces. So in his mind, he knew exactly what she had, that she either had two really big cards or a big pair. And so he took advantage of that with his backdoor draws. So he knows that even if she calls, he still has enough equity to continue. And he had her covered. So that's kind of what my response was. And I think it was a mistake to fold, just based on the character type.
And Rob, you're saying that because the board texture didn't favor a three betting range, like the best hand she can have is an over pair here, that it's a good right. time for this player to apply some pressure. Unless they're three betting, pocket eights, I guess, would be a typical, maybe a three betting hand there. The board was again 8-5-2 rainbow. Chris, you unmuted there. What do you have to say?
I mean, the thing also, so first of all, I think, you know, she named this player. This is one of those things that's, there's like the thing that we go through when we characterize a player in our head and we say, oh, this player is loose aggressive. They're maniacal. They're going to take lots of spots here. And then they follow through with those actions. And it sometimes takes some courage to like follow our read. Right. And I think this is one of those cases where when I read this, if you had described the player beforehand and then told me the action, but didn't tell me the results, I would call this like every day. First of all, I think sometimes when you see players like this, this is a get out of my pot. I mean, this is a 50 big blind shove, right? Are they going to do this with pocket eights? Like, why would you do that? You know, why would you? So, you know, I weight them towards all the kinds of hands that they show up with here, the kind, you know, draws and pretty weak holdings, which our kings are just crushing. And the only thing that they have us ahead of us are the sets. And there's so few combos of that. I just think, you know, sometimes if this is a different player type, if you're telling me this is the old man coffee at the cash game that's just been sitting there for hours, you know, he's got a dusty stack in front of him and just like nothing, has not put anything in, and then suddenly wakes up and does this, I couldn't fold fast enough. But I think in this situation, like I'm excitedly getting the chips in the middle. And if I'm wrong, Well, I've learned a lesson for the next 7 times I have to play this player in this session.
Yeah, I like that. John Somsky, you unmuted next.
Yeah, I'm pretty much going to back up, I think, what Chris said. It does depend a little bit upon the player that you're up against. If they are the type of player that would actually shove with a set of eights here, that does change things. But almost no one should be that type of player, so probably not. But if you look at it, if they're doing it with any semi-bluff, so, I mean, a 6-7 would be a open-ended straight draw. There are only backdoor flush draws here. You could have a 3-4, 2-pair, which would have us in trouble, would be another case. But even if you put all those combinations in, I still think you end up coming out ahead with the call. So, yeah, I tend to agree. I tend to call maniacs down, maybe a little too much, but that would be my play as well.
I'm writing that down, John, for future play. Sasha, you had unmuted next. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to say parenthetically, I just want to respond to what Chris said. Like the whole I know we're talking about a tournament hand here on the whole notion of old man coffee has been very reinvented. And there's many quote, what you would think of as old man coffees who are absolute terrors in Vegas live cash rooms. Okay. We need to really let go of the phrase. It doesn't apply anywhere. I liked listening to the intro to this hand, Jim, and thinking about the question tell me again, the woman, Elizabeth, right?
Elizabeth,
I was interested in her comments and some of the mindset issues, some of the mental game issues. Super lags, hyper aggros, super whales, there's any number, the lexicon is wide, how they're described. You know, they have a disruptive style. They're emotionally committed to that disruption. They like to be irritations. She referred to him as her nemesis or in this league or whatever. I would invite her to think about, they can feel, depending on our playing style, lags can feel threatening or overwhelming, or that's too big of a word. But I think that there's some exploration and some work to be done there. Lags are extremely vulnerable as players. And once you figure out what, and even in a cash context, whether tournaments or cash, I think it's extremely hard to be very wide and splashy in a tournament context. It's extremely difficult. And I think that this, when one starts to explore and study and think about the psychology of lags, what they need, when Elizabeth might start to understand that, and start to practice some detachment from the personality, I think that, that's work that she can do. She can't stop somebody playing like this or somebody, you know, shoving a flop with blah, 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 with garbage effectively. The mental game work around the lag personality is some of the hardest and best and most profitable work that we can do with players wherever we're playing.
I like that point. Joseph, you had unmuted next. What's on your mind?
Yeah, now, as you're describing this hand, if you followed any of the WSOP or the main event this year, there was the Nick Rigby, Jason Kuhn.
Oh, yeah.
Rigby had the aces. Jason didn't believe him. He called all in with an ace king and he's out. And I mean, that propelled Rigby to what, day 5, I think, you know, 5 or 6. So, you know, it is hard to get away from that because, yeah, you do call them down and then, you know, you get your hand smacked, you're out of the tournament. So I probably would have folded there. That's a tough spot. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, because that is something that these aggressive players have going for them, is that when you build an aggressive image, then you're more likely to get paid when you have the strong hands, right? I mean, that is part of the value of playing aggressively. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's enough equity there for the aggressive player to do exactly that. I mean, they played it perfect, you know, because there's still enough equity, there's still enough outs. No, it was a gut shot with the backdoor flush, but yeah, I think it was played very well. And we can get into this in another, you know, podcast or session, but OMCs are absolutely alive and well. Go to South Point. You know, they don't have to be old man coffees. They can be OWCs as well. You see them everywhere.
That's right. I've even seen some YMCs. You know, they're taking over the entire age demographic spectrum. They're out there. Those super nits are out there. Be careful. Joe, did you have something to add into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Apple in my eye or response kind of exemplifies something that Sasha was talking about is it's like it's the nemesis in the tournament. You're never playing one person in a tournament. You're playing against the equity. And a part of poker is the fact you have to become comfortable with losing. Now, I know that's an obvious statement, so please don't flood my inbox with, duh, Joe, you know, we get it. But Apple of my eye says something very interesting. He says, I'm sorry that this person plays like that and doesn't make it something along those lines. It doesn't make it fun for everybody at the table. It's like, that's not his job. You know, his job is to put you in a tough spot, to put you in the blender and make you make a decision when he probably has some equity. And your job is to make a decision with the best amount of information that you have so that you can be comfortable with losing in that spot if you get drawn out on, or if he does show up with a set. You know, I think that the poster is smart. I think she kind of knows what the answer to this question is that she just didn't want to do it because there was some feeling of nervousness about, well, if he does show me this, I'm going to feel badly about it. But it's a damn good spot. And, you know, with kings with no flush draw and no real obvious straight draw, sometimes they got it and sometimes they're going to get there. And then you just have to be comfortable with, well, I guess I buy back in. Otherwise, it's more important for you to stay in the tournament than to win the tournament.
So. Yep. Sasha, you unmuted next.
Yeah, I just want to respond to what Joe said. And I love that idea. That's so interesting that someone says he doesn't make it fun or he makes it unfun if he's playing like that. That's such an interesting observation from a mindset perspective. I mean, obviously, this is another like gigantically obvious statement, but I'm actually reading Janu Negreanu's book from 2008 that I didn't even know existed. And he's got cash contributors to the book, but there's his whole section is about tournaments. And this idea that you play cautiously or in tournaments, and the tournament text that I have read from Matt Matros and others, the idea that you play cautiously, you're responding so not to bust out, seems a less optimal point of view and perspective and approach in terms of how you're responding. I love what Joe said. It's about it's an equity question. And also someone said to me a long time ago, if you figure out like what, does somebody want you to fold or call? And it's like a very simple, not so much a metric, but something.
Yeah, it's like a binary thing. It's like they.
Yeah. And to John's point, is somebody, I wasn't tracking the number of blinds, et cetera, but is it to their advantage to shove a flop with a set of, as opposed to bet or raise or have somebody just to get more money into the pot, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I also go into that mode, that like binary mode sometime where it's like, well, they want me to fold. So how bad a hand can I have and still call? Like, what's the worst hand I can feel good about calling with as a bluff catcher here? And then like, okay, do I have that good hand? I do. All right. Then I'm just going to call because it feels like I'm trying to stymie their intentions. And that is a part of poker. Joseph.
Yeah, just does it say what stage of a tournament? I know it said, you know, 75 big blinds or whatnot had covered, but are there any ICM implications here? Mm-hmm. You know, is it on the bubble for points or whatnot? I guess that would be another determining factor there.
Yeah, great point. So this one at the 200, 400 level, I'm guessing that's like the third level. And
the 200.
I'm guessing. Yeah. But I know the points do count all the way down. Like everyone who's in the tournament gets a certain number of points. So it's more of a soft, it's not really a bubble, but there are ICM considerations for sure. Chris?
Yeah, I was just, I don't even need to add anything. I was just,
no.
by all the facts here, it seems like it's early because everyone, you know, we're deep stacked. They're, you know, they're not that big of levels. She doesn't even mention an ante yet.
No.
So I think we're early.
Yeah. And you don't want to go broke early with one pair. You know, that's one of those rules, right? But, you know, poker is a game of weighing the general rules and finding out which ones should be the biggest influence on your decision. Joe, do you have something?
I don't know that I agree with that statement, and that wasn't what I unmuted about, because I think you could go broke with one pair in the right situation early in the tournament. I mean, it's we look at things from a recreation poker player standpoint at times where I think it was the traveling duo, the Poker Pilgrims, talk about enjoyment EV, right? It's like I paid my money. And therefore, I want to earn a certain amount of EV by just being here and being in the game. And that's something that people can win, right? But if you're going to go far in the tournament, which people in rec poker often talk about wanting to do, you have to be prepared to walk in, have aces, put all your money in pre-flop against somebody who's raising big because that's the right thing to do, and then get busted out by a pair of jacks, right? That's right. What you have to be prepared for to do to be successful, because otherwise you're turning down spots so you cannot go broke early. Right. So I think I don't mean to, you know, I think those rules, that's something Andrew Brokus has said a lot. It's like the rules aren't rules. The rules are just suggestions of different things. And a lot of times the rules that we've seen from days of yore don't apply anymore now that we have a better handle on what the EV of various hands are, particularly in larger samples. And I think that, you know, what I had unmuted for was really to talk about in a cash game, you want that maniac at your table, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just going to, you can just knit it up and sit and wait and hit them hard. And they're the ones that are going to feed you when you can cast the punt. Now, you have to, when I sort of started playing, one of my coaches said, he just looked at me when I was kind of complaining in the same way, because everybody goes through these stages of hatreds of lags, right? If you start out as a lag, you end up losing your entire stack many, many times, and you realize you can't play lag. And so you have to tighten up and you become a tag, and then the lag is beating the crap out of you. And you're like, how am I losing to this guy? I'm playing all the right things. Well, the fact is you have to strap in, right? Because a lag plays a high variance style trying to get you to fold, and you got to call him down in situations whereby he... Or she is trying to force you off of your hand by playing from behind. And if you can do that, it can be wildly profitable to play against lags, but you have to strap in.
Yep. You have to strap in. I like that. I think that's right. Rob?
I was just going to say, we briefly touched on this, but this is a home game series where they're playing for a WSOP main event buy-in. I've played in these before, and typically what happens is, based on your position of when you bust out of the tournament, that gives you a set amount of points.
Yeah.
So it, and in this one, this is a short one because it's only 8-game series. I've played in them where they were, you know, 12-game series or 11-game series where they have one a month. For 10 months, and then they award the prize. And typically there may be one table or two table type tournaments. It's typically that type of environment in a home game, at least the ones that I've been involved in. So I think one of the things that we didn't talk about is the importance of laddering up no matter what, because you're getting points each game.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I played in the same series last year, I think, or maybe the year before, I played in the main event for, because I won the series. Kim and Elizabeth and Stewie were kind enough to invite me to play in it once. I just came and won it. it was a good feeling. But you're right, Rob. At the end of the series, the points are very typically very close. And so the difference between going out, you know, very late in 1 week versus holding on for a few more spots, it does come up. That being said, I mean, I really like what Joe said, which is that you do have to seize the plus EV spots that come to you. Even if some of these general rules are pushing you away from it, other general rules are going to be pushing you towards it. And you can't just completely knit up. And just fold your way. You can't like fold your way to the big points, I guess is what I'm saying, a structure like this. So you do need to take some chances insofar as, you know, we're talking about these. Sasha, you unmuted first and then Joseph.
Yeah, this is so interesting. Thanks everybody for great ideas. I mean, this idea, like there's a lot I feel like, and I don't know, and I want to pose the question to the group because on the cash side, there's a number of strategies for dealing with lags. Everything from information denial, you know, I don't like the phrase knitting it up. I just don't, I think it's always an insult. There is a question of patience and finding spots. I called a crazy woman down recently with a 9 high. Based on I'd watched her play for 3 hours and then something happened in her physical tells in the final moment when she put me in, all in, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a whole range of spots. But what I also love about how on the, at least on the cash side, I analyze how lags deal with certain parts of their ranges, for example. Lags are really cheap. They're in a lot of hands. The way Ed Miller talks about, what do folks do with their extra hands? Are they folding them? Are they bluffing with them? Are they checking with them? What are they doing with them? So I watch to see what lags do when they have more equity. They often, you know, their raises are different from their re-raises, for example, at different points in the life of a hand. And so there's all kinds of strategies for dealing with lags on the cash context. So my question to you guys, for the benefit of our audience, is it simply in a tournament context that you're just being brave and calling down with, in this case, kings is hardly a little bit of equity, but is it just simply being brave in a tournament context? Because on the cash side, there's a lot of different strategies.
Yep. Chris, do you want to just jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm far less experienced a cash player. So, but I do think there is a tournament type of player that that takes that kind of the post-flop experience and likes to, because nobody can just reload. Well, sometimes you can rebuy, but you can't just pull out of your pocket and put more chips on the table. It's going to change your whole dynamic that, sometimes they can, I've seen a lot of these like 50, 60, 70 big blind sort of check raise shoves post flop. And I think it's a common play from a certain type of player, in my experience. And I think it's more tournament based. I am not as much of a cash game player, but I don't see it as frequently. And usually it is not extreme strength. It might have value. It might be like on this board where you have an 8-5 deuce board, this might be like ace-8.
Ace-8, yeah.
Ace-8 totally. Suited feels like or pocket nines. Things like that feel like really common plays where this is happening. But they're kinds of hands that kings will dominate most of the time.
Joseph, you had something to add, and then Joe?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Just, I think in a cash game, yeah, I think this is a snap call. They're just completely different, you know, ways of playing the tournament versus cash. But in sports, we talk about this a lot, is some teams play to win and some teams play not to lose. And I think that's a big part of poker as well, is, you know, you kind of have one of two players, ones that are there to, you know, to win, to put the chips in when they need to, and others, again, kind of the knitting it up thing, you know, just playing not to lose. And those are the ones that usually end up getting blinded out unless they get, you know, an insane number of hands late.
Yeah, that's like the way you think about that, Joseph. Joe?
The only thing I was going to add is that, as always, stake matters. I think there's wide differences in terms of how a live 1-2 or 2-5 game is going to play in comparison to a 5NL, 10NL, 50NL, 100NL game, all the way through, because the online, you're going to have many narrower edges, and that's going to change how you may approach somebody. And particularly at the very low, there's nosebleeds, and what's there's like nose congestion domains, the very low stakes.
we'll work on that. We're going to workshop that one. Oh, yeah.
You know, if I have a single pair and somebody jams into me at those stakes, most of the time they have it. And I can just save a ton of money by folding in those spots, even in tournaments, you know, like a $3 sit and go, which I play regularly because I don't have a lot of time because apparently I'm in Vermont doing NPR copy for the news program. But, you know, there are just moments where it's again, know your player. They can be a laggy player, but if they jam, they probably still have it because they're not playing the lag strategy as well, or they're playing it really well. And they'll get you a lot more commonly. I haven't in reviewing my databases, I haven't seen a lot of people that would do this that don't have it. So,
yeah, I think that is another one of those. There's sort of two kinds of players, and then, you know, there's these two kinds of hands that they're going to show up with here accordingly. So I like that. So I am going to dox Apple on my eye, a fantastic member, because I'm going to go through his post here. It's a great guy named Harold Berry. Lives up here in Canada. He's been a premium member here for a while. Harold has this great response here. I'm just going to read it out, and then unless there's any other questions from the YouTube chat or the panel here, we'll wrap this baby up. But Harold says, I'm fine with how you play the hand, but would also be fine with a call. The experience you have with this player tells you there's a good chance you're good. However, you still have a decent stack and may also want to stay out of the way of this loose cannon who can have anything. And then he goes into some of the different hands that he could have that would be ahead of us. And he agrees that it's really, there's only so many value hands that they can have given the action. And then says, I have two competing mindsets when running into this type of player. I'm glad they're in my tournament, bringing their buy-in to the prize pool while taking very little out of it. Throwing some shade there, Harold. unfortunately, it does not make play very enjoyable for you or others at the table. So the question is whether this is a spot to call it off, or am I able to wait for a better spot that I feel more confident with against him or others? And then the competing mindset is, I hate this type of player. If I study anything these days, it's usually material versus a reasonable or at least a semi-reasonable player. My choice of action, call or fold, tells me a little about the quality of my decision, which I can then take and apply against reasonable players. So this is what I find really frustrating and enhances the gambling element of poker. I think talking about these players that are going to play in unconventional ways, who are going to take these lines that we wouldn't find in a textbook, that we have to then sort of decide, are they or aren't they, which does feel more like gambling necessarily than making good informed decisions. We do have a comment here from Evil Roy Slade, our own Dave Westerveld, the inaugural and only member of the Lifetime Achievement Club by winning 50 Rec Poker home games. He's already into his 60s, but I got a couple people on his trail. He says, don't get too caught up on the nit term. It makes sense to tighten ranges playing versus excessive legs. Yes, that's true. And Joseph posts in to say that, yeah, tight doesn't necessarily mean knit, which is a good point. And I want to reinforce that. And we've got some other great comments in the YouTube chat here, which is why I encourage folks to show up on these Monday nights. And then I guess not seeing any other comments from the group here. Rabman50 Washam says, against this type of player, the best way to beat them is to get them to bluff into you. And that's the thought that that jumped out to me when I read this post by Elizabeth, which is that it's the Andrew Brokaw's line, when they move an inch, we move a mile. And if we think that an aggressive player is going to make plays like this, then I agree with Rob that we have to kind of buckle up. And, or I guess Joe mentioned buckling in as well. There was some buckle talk going on earlier. You kind of do just have to buckle up and hold on and call them down light, because the leak that they have is shoving too wide. And even if they're only shoving a little bit too wide, the correct response for you is to call them down light. And I think I probably would have done that in real time here, but I totally get if Elizabeth had some sort of tell on this player that it was a strong hand. I'll defer to her being in the room to make that judgment. But in a vacuum, I think against aggressive players, you should buckle up, hold on, and call down later. And occasionally they're going to have aces, and occasionally they're going to have top set. But if they are the kind of player that bluffs light and shoves wide, mathematically speaking, they're just not going to have it that often. So you might get unlucky that one time. But in the long run, that's the way that I would approach this. Well, we don't often do these live on YouTube, but I'm glad that we did. We got some fantastic conversation going in the YouTube chat. And I want to thank everyone in the YouTube chat for their contributions. And stick around, because we'll be doing another episode right after here and giving away a prize to all our faithful audience members. But I also want to thank the Running Aces Hotel Racetrack and Casino. And of course, all our premium members and our free community members, and Chris, Rob, Joseph, Sasha, John, and Joe for joining me here tonight and having a great time talking poker. We'll see you next week on the Rush Poker Podcast. Have a good night.